changing drastically out in the state. Many of the smaller counties let's take the wet dry issue for instance. It was 5 years, 10 years ago, we had 25, 27, I believe, wet counties in the state. I expect there are 45 or 50 today. The very small counties are calling liquor elections, and voting the county is wet. There's a practical approach to this, more flexible, more sophisticated attitude, and I think the attitudes and philosophies are generally changing in our small counties. They're becoming urbanized. Television has had a massive impact on the thinking, the attitudes of our people. Transportation, the interstate highway system, ease of communication, all of this has served to change attitudes rather substantially, so that many of our so-called rural legislators don't consider themselves, quote, rural, unquote, legislators. They damn well don't consider themselves countrymen, country boys anymore. They come to Atlanta with a rather sophisticated attitude, so that I think the rural-urban lines will become less and less noticeable in the years ahead. You may identify one person from a rural area simply because that's his district, but the chances are that fellow's going to be pretty well sophisticated.
How do you compare the role of organized labor today with, say, 10, 15, or 20 years ago, and where do you see it heading?
Well, it's not a great deal stronger here in Georgia than it was 10 or 15 or even 20 years ago. Organized labor has... Georgians are rather individualistic people. They follow the personality far more than they follow the organization. And this is particularly true, and I think with organized labor, not just Georgians in general, but the working man, he would vote in a second for a colorful, picturesque character like Lester Maddox than he would some sophisticated, hairsprayed, cufflinked young fellow like Carl Sanders. It's when Sanders may very well be the more qualified individual. Nevertheless, this working man sees himself as he relates to the individual rather than the organization. Labor leaders probably endorsing Sanders, labor membership voting for Lester Maddox is the point I'm making there. They just, they're too individualistic. Now, there is some indication that organized labor will be more emphatic in its leadership and the coordination of its membership. This conversation now about intensive telephone campaigns to build a little esprit de corps among the organized labor membership. It's going to take some organizational effort with the members themselves. You just don't dictate to these working men how they should vote. They're going to have to develop they're going to have to relate more closely to their own labor organizations.
Has the biggest change in Georgian politics in the last 25 years been that of the role of blacks in participating in politics?
Well, I guess the participation of blacks in politics and the changing of the county unit system. The county unit system has had a staggering impact, really, on I think it's had a tremendous impact on the change of politics in the state. It's given so much stronger voice to the metropolitan areas, the large and the medium-sized communities. It's brought about a great deal. This, coupled with reapportionment generally, has brought in such an influx of new personalities. That coupled with the participation of the black voter in the state, I think we'll probably see the real impact of the black people in this year 1974, really for the first time. I can remember the old A.T. Walden days when there were 35 or 40,000 black voters, 48 to 50, 52, 54. When you had from 30 to 50,000 black voters, and Judge A.T. Walden downtown here in Atlanta usually passed the word, passed out a ticket a night or so before the election and got the word over the whole state that blacks voted in one solid block. Blacks about as split up and busted up now as white people, and they vote in fragments, and they have excellent leadership, and they have mediocre leadership, and it's coming around, but there is a whale of a heavy registration of blacks now. And by and large, the blacks are not going to vote for a person who stands up and says, I am a segregationist. And Lester's said that a time or so in the last 12 months. I just got an idea that we'll see a remarkable... Well, you're already seeing it. Lester has, since that time, he's apparently come to his senses somewhat, and he's begun, I understand, courting the black vote in a lot of communities. He's going to have to do it to make a creditable showing. And I think that the blacks will make the role of the black voter will be a rather impressive one in this 1974 campaign.
Were you surprised that the flexibility that Herman Talmadge showed in racial matters?
No, not really. I attended a dinner last night in Cedartown, Georgia, with a young fellow, Robert Parks, testimonial dinner in his home community. It was presided over by W.D. Tripp, who's the top banker in that little rural community. And I can remember the days when Tripp referred to Robert Parks as that little nigger friend of yours out here. He'd call me up and talk about that little nigger friend of yours out here. Well, he presided at a testimonial dinner to Parks last night in Cedartown, and a fundraising program for one of the black orphanages in the state. Parks came to Talmadge in that Senate campaign in 1956 with a vision and a feel that the blacks ought to be participating more actively in politics in the state, and that there was a place for the black voter, there was a logic for the black voter to support Talmadge. And he began then, and he put together a whale of a black following for Talmadge. Did it almost privately that summer of 1956. I was coordinating that campaign. I saw it all come together. I had seen Talmadge along about that same time call for a modification of the Georgia County unit system. It made blazing headlines in all the papers across the state. Talmadge is a visionary. He's a very practical person, but he looks ahead and he can anticipate changes. And I've seen him time and time again anticipate change and attempt to gear himself to that change and gear the thinking of the people to that change. Had they modified the county unit system at that time, it might have lasted another 8 or 10 years or longer. But he was met with some rather strong criticism at that time. I don't think that it was any shock that he did gear him to begin thinking in broader terms. He was looking at the future. His thinking is about is from 10 to 20 years ahead of the average voter in the state of Georgia.
Is Talmadge considered, at least by knowledgeable politicians, as somebody who, among other things, performs the traditional role of bringing home the bacon, close quote, from Washington?
Oh,
I mean, is he the key man in the delegation insofar as getting projects approved that people think the state needs, this sort of thing?
He works at projects. He responds to his mail with research and inquiries and hell raising. He can kick a member of the cabinet in the butt if it's necessary to get a project that is needed back home. But to the extent that Dick Russell went of carpeting the state with military bases, Talmadge has never been quite that that materialistic in his politics. He hadn't brought that kind of bacon home. His has been more of a philosophical relationship to the people, more of a national, well, not more of a national sort of leadership than Dick Russell, but he's taken a broad sweeping look at it. His leadership in agricultural programs, of course, has been for the whole spectrum of agriculture, but Georgia has tremendously benefited by it because Georgia is still primarily an agricultural economy. I think Talmadge is, he works hard at his politics, but his is a matter of exposing himself. His is a matter of personal politics rather than just dumping chunks of bacon around over the state.
Am I correct that he is generally considered to be politically untouchable in Georgia?
I would think so. Certainly for this 1974 campaign, he'll have opposition, but it'll be marginal sort of an opposition. Talmadge is campaigning when those who would oppose him asleep or playing golf or drinking liquor or making love or doing something besides organizing and mobilizing opposition for him. He saturates the state with political memoranda, his little congressional letters and reports back home. He saturates to the extent that they use them as public service programs, the TV and the radio stations in the state with the tapes that they repeat. He comes home in the Lincoln Day sessions, the Easter recesses, the Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays, and he hunts quail all over the state. He goes to fish fries and quail suppers and possum hunts and coon hunts and just all sorts of exposure all over the state. He's a tireless sort of a political worker, and he's ubiquitous. He's everywhere. He'll come home for a long weekend and make 7 or 8 speeches around the state, either driving or flying from Bainbridge to Gainesville to Rome to Atlanta. And this kind of exposure is tremendously difficult to confront. In the first place, there are damn few people who have that kind of energy to just get out and campaign tirelessly.
How significant was his role in the Fletcher Thompson Sam Nunn race?
I think it was very significant.
Was it decisive?
Probably made the difference, yes. I think it was highly significant that he, and I think it was a highly practical thing for him to do, just move in at that particular time. Moved into a position of real strong Democratic leadership in the United States Congress, and it was almost necessary for him to take that position just as a, for his own political caveat. Had Fletcher been elected, then Talmadge would have been opposed rather strongly this year by Republicans. Had I been elected a Republican governor, he would have had far less problems down the road. I think we would have lived with him rather than confronted him on every circumstance. I wouldn't have opposed Talmadge. I would have supported him when he ran for re-election in some way, not necessarily overtly, but certainly covertly. I saw the opportunity to gradually build a Republican Party in these realistic situations, like strong leadership. A person like Talmadge, he's a leader. He knows more about politics and government than any other living person in Georgia, probably any other living person in the South. And consequently, he's an exceedingly informed person on finances. He's a very successful and exceedingly knowledgeable farmer. Those are his main roles, finance and agriculture in the Senate. Consequently, we need him. Why junk a fellow that is producing like that? That would have been my philosophy had I been a Republican. That's my philosophy today. I think that's overwhelmingly the philosophy of the people of Georgia.
Have you remained active in the Republican Party?
No, I've been out building shopping centers and condominiums and office buildings and developing. I had to start from scratch, building a new career. And I've been quite active in doing that. I haven't taken much time to really become involved in any kind of politics. I voted for Sam Nunn, so I voted in the Democratic primary. And I supported Nixon vigorously in his campaign for re-election. I think my attitude towards Georgia politics is pretty consistent with the rank and file Georgian. Every Georgian votes in the Democratic primary and he votes Republican in the general election. I imagine that's the way I'll be voting for the next several years.
How do you feel now about Nixon in light of events and disclosures?
I'm grossly disappointed at Nixon's foot dragging on this issue of the tapes. He should have kicked the front door and the back door of the White House wide open and said, "There it is, look at it, take what you want." Or he should have called up this old fellow from North Carolina, what's his name, Irvin. He should have called him up and said, "Sam, those tapes are down here and you can come down and listen to them, but I've used South Pacific language all the way through there, and it ain't no way in the world I can expose the harsh language that I've used on those tapes to the American public, and I ain't gonna release them. It'd be embarrassing to me and my wife and my family, and you can come down and hear them. Otherwise, I'm gonna burn them tomorrow morning. I'd have burned the damn things." He should have met the issue head on. And then dropped it and taken the consequences. But he's drug his feet at every turn. He's yah-yahed about many of the icky aspects of Watergate. And it's been a gross disappointment to me. I think Nixon has been a tremendous leader. And had it not been for the scandal and the smear and the stupidity of Watergate, and his miserable handling of the situation, he would retire as one, he'd be going out of office as one of the really great leaders. Look what he's done in our relationship with the rest of the world. He's created a liaison, a communication with China, with Russia. He sent this fellow Kissinger, and it hadn't been just Kissinger. Kissinger, in the first place, he had to be appointed by someone. He was appointed by Nixon. Nixon understands this finesse of working with other people and turning the other cheek. He's gone to these people and said, "Listen, let's quit arguing. Let's get along." And that's the old concept of the way to lose an enemy is to way to whip your enemies to make friends of them. And that's what he's done. We mentioned very much early on the other side of your tape what he has done for the United States Supreme Court. He demonstrated real leadership in 70 and 71 in the domestic field with economics. He brought the economy to a good, strong, solid stance. that 68 and 69 era that was so miserable and wretched. He pulled us out of it, stabilized the system, and now it's shot to hell because he hasn't taken the time and hasn't had the time to provide the leadership. I think he has ability. I think he's demonstrated great ability. The real disappointment is the way he drug his feet in these Watergate disclosures. If there's enough information on the damn tapes to exonerate him, why in the hell doesn't he exonerate himself?
That's a big question. Is there anything else on Georgia politics that you want to comment on that we didn't discuss?
I don't know. I don't really know what you're attempting to cover in your book. Just
sort of a grasp of how the political system works in the state. How does it work in Georgia with the legislature and the governor? Who really has power in Georgia?
Well, the power is rather fragmented in the state now. Talmadge has always had this philosophy that he would not involve himself in anybody else's race, and he didn't except in Sam Nunn and Fletcher Thompson's. He's never involved himself. He didn't involve himself when he was in state government. He didn't get involved in national and senatorial and congressional campaigns. Now from Washington, he remains absolutely aloof from gubernatorial politics down here. He made the point once that he'd supported Marvin Griffin for governor, and then he supported Ernie Vanderford for governor, and he made the point once that he'd elected one rascal and one idiot, and he thought that was enough. And he hasn't participated in politics since that time.
Did he take any role at all in the decision on Maddox versus Callaway?
To my knowledge, he didn't lift a finger. He didn't speak a word, say a word to anyone.
Even privately.
I think that he quietly giggled and rejoiced that Ellis Arnold had been defeated, and had been defeated by, of all people, Lester Maddox. Because Herman has a long memory and a very deep respect for his father. But he didn't care that was just a rather poetic sort of a settlement of issues. Ellis Arnold had whipped Herman's father, Gene Talmadge, at one time. So I am sure that he giggled quietly at the fact that Ellis had been defeated, and had been defeated by, of all people, Lester Maddox. Beyond that, he said nothing. He still doesn't involve himself in politics. When there were these five of us in the state capitol, we rather aggressively got involved in, too much involved in other races. We elected a member of the Public Service Commission, and state treasurer, those old Wiregrass Mafia, the Capitol Clique boys, helped me to get elected and whip the first incumbent over a long span of years.
What was that term they used after your switch? And they call you some of the five, switching five or something like that?
I don't know. I got a bunch of cartoons of that era on the wall up in my fish cabin, but it's in the mountains. I don't know what that could have been. I don't remember a nickname that came out of that. I've sort of washed that out of my mind, really. I don't know. I think politics is tremendously fragmented in the state just now. The press doesn't exercise any great influence. It's probably a negative influence. We don't have any real newspaper leadership in the state. Old Ralph McGill could inflame and irritate and antagonize people and, in one sense, drive them in the opposite direction. He could elect a governor by negative, in a negative sense. Reg Murphy is an absolutely delightful young fellow to sit down and drink a cup of coffee, a glass of beer with, but he doesn't have that pizzazz that McGill has. Jack Spaulding is the probably wins all the blue ribbons for cynicism, is the editor of the Atlanta Journal, and exercises no leadership. He's sort of a lazy
cynic. What's the role of his brother, the lawyer? What's his name?
Hughes. He has one brother, Hughes, who's in the King and Spaulding firm. He's a bond lawyer, a sophisticated lawyer, a rich lawyer, and a very fine, remarkably fine person.
Roy Harris said that he was as much political influence as anybody in Georgia was. When he was exercising, he wanted exercising.
His father did. Mr. Spaulding was quite an impressive old gentleman, and I guess that Hughes, young Hughes, has a lot of by virtue of his law practice and the wealth that he's exposed to and that he represents there. He could have a real impact, but he's simply not interested. And I think it's a damn tragedy that, that people like him, they yawn at the idea of politics. It's a little boring to them when it should be a full-time hobby.
How significant do you consider that in Georgia there are no really experienced political press corps?
I think it's a damned shame and really a tragedy that we don't have an experienced press corps. I can remember old Jean running against, there was M.L. St. John for the Constitution, and what was his name? Gregory. His last name was Gregory for the Atlanta Journal. I guess it wasn't Cecil Gregory. Something Gregory with the Atlanta Journal. Old Jean would campaign against St. John and St. Gregory. And they were professionals, and they kept him on his toes. He knew they were watching constantly. Charlie Pugh was an exceedingly professional political reporter for the Atlanta Journal. Last one they've had around here. He's with an agency of the federal government now. The newspapers pay him, just $400 and $500, maybe $600 a month, and they bring these kids in virtually off the street, and as soon as a young fella with the newspapers can learn his way around and write enough fine story or two, he goes to work for some politician as his public relations man because he'd make more money. I think it's has had a drastic impact on the state government. Guys like Charlie Pugh would dig in underneath the cover. Why was that decision made? Why do we need to reorganize state government? Why was this fellow fired as head of the mental health program? Why is this purchasing agent here being so royally entertained so many directions? Why is he driving now an Oldsmobile 98 instead of a Chevrolet Chevelle? He digs in. He would dig into to things like that, and he knew politics, and he knew government, and he knew people, and he created, in effect, a sort of a fear. And I think people behave much better. We see that on the highways we drive, and we behave much better when we're being observed. And the present press corps in the state of Georgia, the press corps we've had in the state of Georgia for about the last 4 years now, has been pretty sophomorific, and the sophomores just don't know enough about what's going on to observe closely and keep people on their toes. Consequently, we may have more misbehavior in state government than we realize. The public has no way of knowing. I don't know. I don't keep up with it. I think we got some mediocre people over there that ought to be thrown out of office. And I think that a real wise, informed, intelligent press would be very helpful in identifying the mediocrity of some of those people. Pointing it up, just press interviews. Just talk about what they're doing, what they're not doing. Some people take the attitude, you know, that the less they do, the less publicity they get, and the less publicity they get, the fewer people know that they're there. Consequently, the less they do, the less opposition they have, the longer they stay in office. And that's the reverse of where it ought to be. And if you don't pay any attention to them, they damn surely stay there forever. I think that politics in Georgia is probably more fragmented today than it has been in my lifetime, political leadership at least.
Well, this is an impression we've gotten, is that Georgia really is very diffused leadership politically. That Carter's major problem with the legislature has been his running feud with Maddox as lieutenant governor and Maddox's alliance with Hugh Gillis, which, as I understand, is a reaction in part to Carter's firing his father and that split. Mm.
Well, Carter's sort of a damn sissy, really. He's
One person told us that Carter politicked the state for 3 years running for governor. Then after he got elected, forgot about the art of politics.
Well, I don't think he ever knew the art of politics. He knew the art of shaking hands and stirring around. And people were looking for an alternative for Carl Sanders. I waged my campaign that summer against this guy, Hal Suit, rather ignoring him because I thought he was just a damn TV announcer from WSB and really had been a pretty good friend of mine in the years past. I waged my campaign against him by ignoring him and really needling Carl Sanders. And I really believe I did about as much as Jimmy Carter did during that summer to whip Carl Sanders. They gave him the nickname Old Cufflinks, and We kidded a lot about Carl, and Carl is really a fine fella. He knows government and was a pretty good governor. I served over there with him, but he was an opponent at that time. And we talked about his hairspray and the fact that you couldn't find a single voter in Georgia who had ever seen Sanders sweat. And you could ask the guys down on the creek banks if they were wanted a man up there who'd never been able to work up a real sweat. It was just a lot of... That was a fun part of the stop speaking part of the campaign.
How do you rate the people who've been governor of Georgia since 48?
Since 48?
Well, I guess it'd start with Ellis Arnold.
No, Ellis Arnold was governor before 48.
I thought it was 46 to 50, wasn't it?
44 to 46. He was governor, 44 to 46. Then M.E. Thompson served for 2 years, and heck of a nice fella, but he was surrounded by, had a few rascals in his structure over there, and he was thrust into just a wild political situation, just a maelstrom of activity around, you know, that all the Talmadge organization that had Ellis Arnold in there all during the 4 years, and it elected old Gene, and he died before he was sworn in. They were all mad and bitter, and they took it out on poor old M.E. So he really didn't have much of a chance. Herman served for 2 years and drank a lot of liquor and really was sort of thrust in there and almost lost his campaign for re-election in 50, or he could have lost it if he hadn't come to his senses, but he came to his senses and became a real successful governor. Probably the greatest governor, unquestionably to me, the strongest governor we've had in my lifetime, my political memory. He was succeeded by Marvin Griffin, who was a jolly, grand old jolly rascal. Not a thief, but he had some thieves in his organization who gave him just a black name that he still hasn't completely lived down, but an absolutely delightful, jolly, and quite a sincere person himself, personally. Excellent wife and a very fine young son. Then there was Vandiver, who I don't think was... All that dumb, he was just butt-headed. He was a butt-headed, stubborn mountaineer. and came at a time of great change. The county unit system was thrown out, and the schools were, the integration was, we were moving towards integration. Integration of the transit system, and some rather noticeable integration began taking place in Vanderbilt's town. He had two or three heart attacks. He couldn't stand the pressure. He was booed when he went down to speak to the Georgia Education Association one evening. He had a heart attack the next day. He just couldn't stand that kind of pressure out there. He was virtually appointed governor by Talmadge. Talmadge came home and visited and stirred around the state in the summer of 57. Everywhere he went, people either asked him who you're going to vote for next year, and if they didn't bring up the question of politics, he'd say, "How's Ernie running down here?" So they got the word that he was interested in Ernie, and Ernie became governor. He didn't have much of a campaign then in the summer of 58 when he ran. He was average or above average in considering all the circumstances that he faced. Then came Sanders, who was probably the most effective governor, second to Talmadge, along that sweep of times. I think old Lester just had a good time while he was over there. He wasn't a particular rascal. He wasn't particularly indecent or crooked. He just didn't really know a lot about what was going on, and appeared most of the time not to give a damn about what was going on. If he could get his picture in the paper, and if he could control his temper. Lester's hot-headed and too hot-headed. I think that's one of his problems, one of the reasons he may be defeated this year. He loses his temper, and instead of calling everybody a son of a bitch, as some of us do, he calls them a communist. And most Georgians would rather be called a son of a bitch than to be called a communist. And now Carter has been, pretty much of a sissy in the governor's office. He hasn't really known how to make decisions, had no experience, hadn't known how to make decisions and follow through. He was elected governor not so much on his own steam. He was elected governor as an alternative to Carl Sanders. Sanders had projected himself out way too far to the left. And if Georgia people are ever given a choice between a man over here at 11 o'clock and at 1 o'clock, they're going to vote for the man at 1. They'll vote for the man at 12:10 before they will a man at 11. To the right of middle is where the Georgia voter, the rank and file voter, is going. And that's been true all this century. They're going to vote to the right of the middle. Now, in a moral situation where Sanders and Griffin were opposing each other, Sanders was to the left of middle and Griffin was to the right of middle. But Griffin had a moral taint on his reputation because of his brother and some of his staff people over there. And when the moral issue comes up, the Georgians are not going to vote for a rascal.
What was Garland Byrd's problem in that race?
I think one of Garland's problems had been his own personal morals around the state. There was a lot of criticism. He'd been an exceedingly promiscuous person, and this was just sort of everyday talk among just household knowledge among housewives and women voters around the state, who by and large resent the hell out of a promiscuous husband. Garland, too, never was able to really project sincerity. His speeches had he could make an excellent point, but his delivery had an artificial delivery to it. He'd pronounce words differently from the stump, from just a routine conversation such as this. And that artificial ring came across. And I think that these are the reasons that he was defeated. He didn't have the thing. And Garland had some negative attitudes building up against him for years. I remember an editorial that about buried when he was director of the State Department of Veterans Service in 48 or 50. He was deputy director, I think. He just used his state expense account there to travel all over Georgia and all over the country. And I remember the editorial was headlined, Marco Polo Buried. And little negative needles and jabs like that about, the fellow, they accumulate over a period of time.
How about campaign financing in Georgia? Where does the money come to finance politics?
There's no one big sugar daddy in the state.
Nearest thing to it.
Coca-Cola puts money in campaigns, but they don't feed all that much. They get credit, and they accept the credit because they enjoy the credit. But there's never been that sort of just massive unloading of money to finance a whole campaign. We haven't had it in this state, as in some states, as has been the case in reportedly in some states. It's a pretty tough job to finance a campaign in Georgia. I waged 3 vigorous campaigns across this state, and I came out of each one with a real deficit. Two of those campaigns, I was the incumbent insurance and finance commissioner. If it was easy to raise money, it should have damn well been easy for me to raise money in the financial community of the state. But people are just not geared up in Georgia to major campaign contributions. And we're past those days of real strong personality leadership.
How big a factor is television?
Politics is probably more monotonous and more boring in Georgia today than it's been in 50 years.
What effect does television have?
I think it's had a massive effect in Georgia and every place. You can make 1 point in 30 seconds on television and require you a whole summer of campaigning to do across the state.
What would happen if Gene Talmadge suddenly were reincarnated and re-entered Georgia politics?
I think it'd be a very progressive, a very aggressive leader, very much like Herman. Herman got his flexibility from his daddy. And had his daddy been sworn in early 1947 and served those 4 years, 47 through 51, as governor of Georgia, he would have probably been branded by some as a liberal. He had the capacity to be a very flexible sort of a person. He had some plans for that 4 year period of time that would have probably been a hell of a shock to a lot of his old trench fighters out in the state, of his old warriors from the past battles.
What was he planning to do?
Oh, taxes. He'd given a great deal of thought to sales taxes, revitalizing the tax structure. Much more streamlined road program in the state, revamping the system of education. He had some strong feelings about the penal system. That in the context of today, looking back, we look today at them as his thinking is rather ordinary. But at that time, it was damned progressive.
Is there anything else that we haven't covered?
Oh, there must have been millions of things we haven't covered.
I'm sure.
I'm sure you got enough. If I can fill you, visit with you later on, let me know.
Okay. Anything that comes to mind that you wanted to add?
Hope this has been some help to you.
Yeah.